Hi, I'm Ranika. I'm finishing my internship with The World. For the past 7 months, I've been working closely with the digital team to bring you the stories you love from the radio to our website and social media. The World is special because we bring you important issues from across the globe, told through human voices. With misinformation on the rise, funding for public media to tell stories on the ground is more important than ever. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Your support means the world to our newsroom. Thank you. And now, the show.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
Migrants crossing the Darien Gap are documenting their journeys on TikTok and Facebook, helping guide others through a dangerous stretch to North America. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. On today's show, what the videos don't show.
Sexual violence, attacks, and robberies. These are definitely not things that are being mentioned on the social media channel.
Also, we'll test drive an electric vehicle from China that likely won't be coming to the U.S. market.
It's so weird. It's silent. I'm not used
to silent.
Because it's an electric car.
Plus, 20 airlines are under fire in Europe for greenwashing. They claim they've improved sustainability.
Whereas in truth, the progress, to the extent there's any, is frankly microscopic.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here. With Vladimir Putin's two-day state visit to China, the stakes are sky high for Russia, especially when it comes to trade and energy.
During their meeting today, the two leaders condemned the U.S. and agreed to strengthen ties. Putin called their cooperation one of the main stabilizing factors in the international arena.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping described the Sino-Russian alignment as hard-earned, a relationship the two sides should cherish and nurture. But the leaders still have a lot to hash out, including Moscow's war in Ukraine and a long-in-the-works natural gas pipeline that would connect Russia and China via Mongolia.
To learn more, we reached out to Isabel Hilton, the founder of the nonprofit China Dialogue Trust. She told me the summit is proof China and Russia are consolidating and deepening their relationship.
That wasn't entirely expected, maybe 18 months, 2 years ago, where it seemed as though Russia's actions could be to the detriment of China, and China might, you know, kind of at least exercise some restraint in its support. But since then, we've just seen the Chinese support for Russia grow and grow. As you say, there's a discussion around a new pipeline, Power of Siberia 2. I should say that the last time a pipeline was agreed, which was just after the 2013 invasion of Crimea, and Russia was rather desperate for new markets, the Chinese struck a very, very advantageous deal. Mm. So I think what's being haggled over in the pipeline is really about the price.
So Russia's economy, you know, of course, took a big hit after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine when Europe stopped buying natural gas from Russia. China has stepped up its purchasing, picking up the slack. How important is that existing revenue from gas and other fossil fuels to Russia right now?
Well, the revenue, and particularly from oil, is extremely important. And China is now Russia's major customer, and Russia's nearly China's major supplier. And that has been an absolute lifeline. The quid pro quo for China is that China gets to sell particularly internal combustion engine cars in Russia. There's no market for them, particularly in China anymore. So that's good for China. And the other great benefit, I think, for China is that it can conduct this trade in renminbi, in Chinese currency. And China's very interested in weakening the dollar hold on global markets because being locked out of those markets would matter a great deal to China. So China's sort of quietly trying to build alternative systems, but it's also keen to avoid secondary sanctions. So it's quite a kind of delicate game it's playing, but it's learning a lot with every day that passes.
Why has she so far not signed on to the Power of Siberia 2 gas pipeline? You mentioned it's probably mostly price haggling that's happening right now. Is it just this price negotiation that is holding things back?
I think it's largely a price negotiation. There was some argument about the route of the new pipeline and, you know, the costs of building it. So I think China plays hardball on these negotiations. But I don't think that's necessarily indicative of a cooling of the relationship, because the rhetoric is more and more aligned. The degree of diplomatic cover that China is giving to Russia has only grown over the last 2 years. If you look at things like Xi Jinping's recent visit to Europe, it was pretty much a slap in the face to the European Union. He visited Macron to talk about strategic autonomy, which is code for don't follow the United States. Mm-hmm. And then he visited Serbia to commemorate the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy during the Kosovo War. And then he went to Hungary, which can be relied upon to veto inconvenient resolutions, both in NATO and the European Union. So it was, you know, a declaration of Chinese strength, if you like, and of its alignment with Russia's interests.
And as Russia and China get increasingly cozy, I suppose one could say, does that risk alienating China's relationship with Europe even further and alienating that key trade relationship?
It does risk alienating Europe, but Europe is still largely driven by German interests, and German interests are still very keen on the Chinese market. So I think that, you know, the divisions in Europe, which are increasingly evident about actually what to do about China, again, work to China's advantage and to Russia's advantage. And fostering those divisions has become a kind of joint project.
A similar question about the U.S. How do China's ties with the U.S. economy figure into Xi's calculations during this visit? Those two economies are so deeply intertwined.
Yes, we hear a lot about reshoring and friendshoring and decoupling, but the figures don't really support it. And it's partly that the US corporate interests are still, you know, very tied to the Chinese economy, partly that it just takes a long time to find alternative sources of supply for a whole range of items. And that, I think, in descending order of importance, you know, the tensions over advanced technologies and over strategic minerals, I think that those are getting the kind of major attention. And it will simply take a huge amount of time, if it happens at all, to decouple the rest of the high volumes of trade that we've built up over 30 years.
Isabel, final question here. What are you going to be most closely watching as this trip concludes tomorrow?
Well, I think that we should watch the language around Ukraine. China has put forward what it calls a 12-point peace plan. It's really 12 bullet points without any diplomatic underpinning. But 2 years into the war, with doubts about continuing US support after the next election, with a certain weariness setting in Europe, with the rise of right-wing parties that tend to be more aligned with Russia, you can see that the moment might arise in which China can plausibly present its peace plan and finally bring Russia in behind it. This would not, in my view, be a peace plan that was very advantageous to Ukraine. And in 2 years of the Ukraine war, all Ukraine has had from China is one telephone call to Zelensky from Xi Jinping. So I don't think there's any doubt about where China's weight would be put. But I think that that's an issue to watch, because you can feel that the moment may be approaching where, whether we like it or not, such a proposal would have to be taken reasonably seriously.
Isabel Hilton is the founder of the nonprofit China Dialogue Trust.
As we just heard, Russia is hoping to deepen its trade relationship with China, while the U.S. is going in the opposite direction. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden announced a plan to quadruple tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, bringing the total levies on those EVs to 100%.
Because we're not going to let China flood our market, making it impossible for American auto manufacturers to compete fairly.
This all but ensures Chinese EVs will stay out of the U.S. market. In a lot of the rest of the world, though, and not just in China, people are driving Chinese EVs and loving them. One of the many places they've been popular is Australia. The World's Sarah Birnbaum visited an electric car showroom in Sydney to check out the vehicles Americans won't be driving anytime soon.
My husband Brian and I checked out a BYD showroom in the Burbs. BYD stands for Build Your Dreams, and the Chinese company is now the largest maker of electric vehicles in the world. The store is cavernous. There are huge LED screens everywhere, house music, and a little robot that brings you water and snacks.
Hi, I'm a BYD bot. Would you like some water?
The cars are on white pedestals, and above each one, there's a ring of white light. So literally, there is a halo for every car. The first words out of Brian's mouth were, Tesla is screwed.
Why did you think that?
Just the cars are really nice looking.
I mean, like, what were you expecting? Go away, bot.
I wasn't expecting the cars to look as nice and futuristic.
The BYD Seal model, for example, is all swoopy lines with a short back end section. It's a small, sleek sedan, goes 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds, and is supposed to rival Tesla's Model 3 for about $12,000 less. That price tag is too good for many consumers to pass up, says Mike Costello from Cox Automotive Australia. He says China can keep EV prices low for a number of reasons.
One way it does this is through manufacturing scale and leveraging economies of scale.
BYD makes many of its own parts, including the batteries and electric motors, dashboards, headlights. It even owns its own lithium mines. Lower labor costs is another reason the cars are cheaper.
Another is quite generous government incentives and subsidies, which is not uncommon. Many countries do this. China is not alone in doing this, but it happens on a big scale there.
That's what President Biden is talking about when he says Chinese companies don't play fair.
And also is tactical. So a lot of these companies are selling their vehicles at lower margins because they want to make sure they get as much throughput and as much scale as they can to really grow their presence in a market.
And they're quite willing to make less profit to do that, he says. Brian and I decided that we had to take one of these bad boys for a spin. We fasten our seatbelts.
Okay, let's do it.
And turn on the ignition. Now, normally this is where you'd hear the engine starting up sound, but...
It's so weird. It's silent. I'm not used
to it. Silent?
Because it's an electric car. We've never driven an electric car before.
Doesn't make for good radio. And with that, we hit the road.
It feels good. Seat's comfortable. All right, I can try to speed up to, I can go into sports mode and get to 103 seconds.
100 kilometers?
Yeah, 100 kilometers. It's not really that fast. All right, ready?
Whoa. No! Are you crazy? You always do this.
What? He said it goes up to 103 seconds. I gotta make sure he's not lying. Should we get on the highway?
No.
The ride and the quality feel pretty similar to a conventional car, and I'm told Chinese EVs are on par with EVs from other countries. But some consumers and governments have concerns about security. These cars know exactly where you're going, how fast you're going, where you live, where you work, what music you're listening to. I don't know about that, but I can say that the best feature of this car is the ambient lights that you can make purple. And you can set them to pulse to the rhythm of the music you're playing. Clearly, I am a very sophisticated car buyer. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
And now for a few things you might have missed. A man has been charged with the attempted murder of Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico. The alleged gunman fired several shots at close range while Fico was greeting a crowd of supporters yesterday.
The prime minister is now in serious but stable condition. Venezuela's last glacier, La Corona, has disappeared. It is the first nation in the Andes to be without a glacier.
But experts say it will not be the last. Scientists predict that the northern Andes will be glacier-free by the middle of the century due to climate change. And finally, the U.S. military announced that the floating pier it has been building on the coastline of Gaza is complete.
Boats loaded up with humanitarian aid can soon enter a port near Gaza City. The bundles of supplies and provisions will then be picked up in trucks trucks and distributed by aid groups. Concerns do remain for the safety of humanitarian workers delivering the aid across Gaza. Aid workers have been killed in Israeli military operations in Gaza in recent months, and more recently, aid trucks have come under attack.
Those are a few things you might have missed. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Darien Gap is that muddy jungle between North and South America. Crossing it is treacherous, but that did not stop more than 500,000 migrants bound for the U.S. from attempting it last year. Some of them have started documenting their journeys with videos posted to TikTok and Facebook, a guide of sorts to make the trip easier for migrants to come. From Bogota, Manuel Rueda has a story.
Eduardo Ojeda works in a New York City parking lot. He crossed into the U.S. with his family in December after traveling all the way from Venezuela. The journey took them more than a month. It wasn't easy to get here, Ojeda says, but it's not impossible. Ojeda documented the entire journey on his TikTok account with videos that are about a minute long. Here, he's camping in the Darien jungle. Then he took a boat to a village in Panama where the road north resumes. In Mexico, police forced him to get off a cargo train and walk for miles in the rain. In another video, he arrives at a shelter in a small town in Mexico. There are 60 of us sleeping in here, he says in the video, and adds that he's very grateful to the Mexican people. Ojeda says he wanted to document his journey to help those who are currently on their way to the U.S. His videos mention the cost of transport along different segments of the route. They provide suggestions on where to pick up money transfers and the location of shelters in different towns. I saw lots of people getting ripped off by smugglers and losing their money early in the trip, he says. So I wanted to show people that you can save money and do this journey independently. Ojeda wasn't making money from his videos, but there are others who have turned them into a business. Manuel Monterrosa filmed himself crossing the Darien jungle 2 years ago when he made the journey to the United States. Now he has more than 80,000 followers on YouTube and makes a living as a content creator. Last year, Monterrosa returned to South America to make more videos about migration routes. This isn't about promoting illegal immigration, he says. I just want to show people the reality of these places, so that they can make good choices. But social media accounts can also mislead migrants. In Colombia's Darien region, smugglers are using Facebook to sell travel packages that cost hundreds of dollars. The smugglers post interviews with people who make it sound like it's an easy trip, says Bram Ibis, a researcher at the International Crisis Group.
Oftentimes, the route through the Darien is promoted as this jungle adventure proximate to beautiful Caribbean beaches, that it's like a once-in-a-lifetime experience that you will never forget, you will make new friends.
Eva says that social media companies like Facebook should do a better job at blocking accounts that are misleading migrants. He says the smugglers are downplaying the risks of the journey in order to get as many customers as they can.
But then on the other side, we know that there are grave human rights abuses, especially occurring on the Panamanian side of the Darien. We're talking about structural sexual violence, attacks and robberies, and these are definitely not things that are being mentioned on the social media channels.
In New York, Eduardo Ojeda says that he only published his TikTok series after arriving in the United States. He didn't want to upset human traffickers who are profiting from taking people across borders. I didn't want to put my family at risk, he says, because the smugglers are also connected to cartels. Ojeda hopes that refugees and migrants who are heading to the U.S. will find reliable information during their journey. He says many of them have been left with few other choices. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
Many people who go to the spa are looking for a space apart where everyday stress melts away. One spa in Brooklyn is going a step further. It promises to take people out of New York entirely and transport them across the globe. The World's Bianca Hillier pays a visit to the World Spa.
World Spa has picked up a few nicknames online since it opened in late 2022. One person called it the United Nations of Sweat. Another said it's a museum of different spas from different countries. Managing director Lenny Vays puts it this way.
It's more of a theme park for spas.
Regardless of the metaphor, Vays says his goal was to create an authentic experience of the world's spa cultures and customs right here in Brooklyn. He and his team spent a few years doing research and development.
We traveled all around the world to find these different unique experiences.
Vays says his team then consulted with locals to make sure they brought home the right materials. The facility was supposed to be 10,000 square feet, but quickly grew to five times that. Project director Leo Kanyan gives me a tour of the place. The first region customers travel to is Eastern Europe.
This is Poland, Ukraine, Russia, but it's the same culture, and it's called the culture of banyas.
Banyas are kind of like saunas, since both can reach temperatures of nearly 200 degrees. But banyas are a lot more humid. Think of them as a cross between a sauna and a steam room.
So in order to get to this humidity, you have to manually add water not only to the stones, but in the Eastern European tradition, you actually come with the water, you pour it on the walls.
On the wooden walls.
Yeah, and they're not just the wooden walls.
They're special wooden walls made of kello, a unique type of pine found on the border of Finland and Russia. It's more porous than typical pine, and it helps retain the humidity. Spending time in banyas is said to stimulate the immune system and reduce muscle tension. It's supposed to be followed, Kanyan tells me, by a cold shower, which is conveniently one door down.
So about 20 gallons of cold water can get on you to cool you down.
We walk through the rest of the spa, visiting a Polish salt room with walls made with bricks of Himalayan salt. It's meant to treat respiratory problems and increase blood circulation.
And what's on the floor there?
On the floor?
Yeah.
It's the Himalayan salt as
wow.
well. So you can take off your slippers and step on it, and we recommend to dance on it so it gets slightly into you and massages your foot.
Next, we pass through an aromatherapy room, which smells like a forest, and a traditional dry Finnish sauna. Then there's an exquisitely tiled Moroccan hammam, with the highest humidity levels yet at 80%.
So as you open the door, just steam comes right out.
Exactly.
The final destination is Japan. There, saltwater onsen pools range from hot to cold and are known to soothe muscle fatigue.
So what do? You slowly immerse yourself in the hot water. You stay there until you feel like really hot, like about 3, 4, 5 minutes. And then you go to this very cold, deep right there for a few seconds. You get out and return.
Again, the key is the contrast between hot and cold, which is part of every region represented at the spa. Kanyan says despite offering these authentic experiences at World Spa, the city's spa culture is still different from other parts of the globe.
Can you imagine in a corporate New York, people, let's say, discussing, let's spend an evening together in saunas? Not yet.
In Eastern Europe, though, he says talking business in saunas is commonplace.
It's a must. Contracts are being signed in places like that.
Access to the facility starts at $90, cheaper than a plane ticket and no jet lag required. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, New York.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way in just a bit. You're listening to The World.
A traveler takes us through Kazakhstan on foot.
This swish, swish of grass against your legs, mile after mile, day after day. You're just walking into this kind of two-framed painting of green and blue.
The evocative Kazakh plains, plus Punjabi hip-hop and a tree that's been around for more than 20 million years ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The European Union is going after 20 airlines for greenwashing, using language to suggest that their practices are more environmentally friendly than they really are. That includes making statements that the EU calls potentially misleading about carbon offsets and sustainable aviation fuels. Andrew Charlton is managing director of aviation advocacy and independent air transport consultancy in Europe. I asked him for an example of what airlines are doing that the EU is challenging.
What the airlines are doing is saying we are flying more sustainably because we are starting to use sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF as they're commonly known. And that's immediately the problem, because the reality is that about 0.001% of all fuel at the moment is SAF. So yes, it might be more sustainable, but it's completely imperceptible. And the Commission's argument is that to say we are flying more sustainably and so forth implies genuine progress, whereas in truth, the progress, to the extent there's any, is frankly microscopic.
Right. And they're also making claims about offsets and what purchasing carbon offset can do.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Well, do you know how offsets work? The doctor says to you that you're not allowed to smoke anymore. So you pay a person in Africa not to smoke, and then you can keep on smoking. That's how offsets work. Offsets say that we will pollute, but we will plant trees, in effect. Most offsets are very difficult to show that indeed there is a net reduction in emissions.
And so the EU is saying there's not enough science backing up this claim.
Correct.
That you offsetting your flight is actually making your flying more sustainable.
Or to bring it to the legal point, if you like, to make those claims at the front is to mislead the public that they're doing a good thing, capital G, capital T, when in truth, actually, they're making a minuscule difference.
Just remind us, you know, how big of a piece of the climate puzzle is aviation? How important is it that this be figured out?
The argument that the airlines use is, oh, look, aviation's only about 2% of world's emissions. And that sounds very small and very low and quite reasonable. 2%, I want you to know, is about the same number of emissions as Germany. And I don't think we'd look at Germany and say, you know, you blokes are given a free pass. You don't need to fix anything.
And so let's dive into the sustainable aviation fuel issue. Airlines are mandated to have a very small percentage of their fuel be sustainable by 2025. You're saying they are very far off target from that, and they are trying to be required to use less than EU mandates right now. Is that right?
Well, they're trying very hard to be excused from that, even that first mandate. And it should be said that by 2050, the mandate is that some 60% or something of all fuel has to be sustainable aviation fuel. But, you know, we can't get to the first threshold, so there's not much point worrying too much about 2050 at this stage.
And so what are the hurdles? I know that sustainable aviation fuel, you know, there's not a lot of capacity to make it. So what are the biggest stumbling blocks that airlines are facing right now?
The first one is that there simply isn't enough sustainable aviation fuel available, whether it's for aviation or for other purposes, because currently most of those fuels are bio-based. It's either used cooking oil, and I don't know why it is that you can't just use normal oil. It's got to have been heated up and used as cooking oil once before, because that does some magic thing whereby it becomes usable in this form. But there's only so much used cooking oil in the world. Or it can be ethanol, which of course is what is a lot of the sustainable aviation fuel work that's being done in the United States is running down that line, in part because of the farming industry and so forth. Or it can be woody wastes, you know, offcuts from timber mills or trees planted specifically for the purpose of repurposing it for this. It can be things like flax seeds and flax grass and things like that. But for many of the human waste sort of stuff, there is genuinely a limit to that. The second thing for any of the grown things, to make more of it, you are running the risk of taking land use away from other things that we need to use our farmland for, including, you know, food. Frankly, it's very difficult to see any way out of this cul-de-sac. I think this is a dead end.
You think sustainable aviation fuels are a dead end?
No, I think using bio-based fuel is a dead end. That takes us to what are called e-fuels, gas-to-liquid, fuel-to-liquid sorts of processes. That can either be by using hydrolysis or all those sorts of things. So the next problem then is building a system where you can make e-fuels that will be sufficient to replace the current fossil-based fuels. And at the moment, we are a long way short of having really conclusively proved that this is going to work successfully. Most of the work that's being done continues to be experimental, and no one has successfully shown that we can scale up from the sort of experimental, you know, made in a test tube sort of level volumes to actually putting them measured by the ton and put into airplanes. And that's a real problem.
Andrew Charlton is Managing Director of Aviation Advocacy and Independent Air Transport Consultancy in Europe.
As far as tourism goes, Kazakhstan is what they call off the beaten path, but it does have everything: culture, history, and a lot of horses. That's from a video of horse wranglers created by Paul Salopek when he visited Kazakhstan in 2016. Salopek is a journalist with National Geographic and is on a long walk, a 24,000-mile odyssey called Out of Eden, documenting the globe on foot. In Kazakhstan, he came across not just sights, but traditions, many of which date back to the Silk Road. He's with us now to tell us about his experience, this time in Kazakhstan. Hey, Paul.
Hey, good to be talking to you again.
So what we just heard, I mean, I was expecting galloping, but what was going on there with those horse wranglers?
Yeah, those were my walking partners, my Kazakh walking partners, and they were hammering metal stakes into the steppe, the famous steppe of Kazakhstan. You mentioned Kazakhstan, not much comes to mind for people outside the country except for these seas of grass. And we were picketing our horses because we had a couple pack animals along. They were tying them into stakes so they wouldn't wander off at night.
So you arrive in Kazakhstan. What did you see? How did the place feel? And how is it different from the Caucasus and Eurasia?
The night I arrived, it was Christmas Eve, and it was freezing. I mean, Kazakhstan is a cold place, so there was snow blowing sideways. It was dark. Everybody in the streets was wearing what appeared to me T-shirts, and I was freezing my bucket off, wearing every scrap of clothes that I had on. And a friend of a friend of a friend arrived at the dock. Imagine this, crossing a Caspian Sea, getting off a cargo ship, being blurry-eyed. And there's a Kazakh friend holding a cake saying, Merry Christmas.
No way.
That was my greeting.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was great. It was a good harbinger of things to come.
So tell me more about the significance of Central Asia to the famous Silk Road, this important and ancient trade route that stretched from South Asia into Turkey and on into the royal courts of Europe. What role did Central Asia and Kazakhstan play along this trade route?
It tied together tens and tens of millions of people from Africa to Europe to the Far East, China, of course, being the source of a lot of the products. And Central Asia was kind of the nexus. It was the crossroads. These guys controlled the land routes across the belly of Eurasia. And many of the empires there that nobody kind of remembers today were incredibly wealthy because they would tax all the camel caravans, all the folks carrying stuff, say, from Venice to Xi'an, not just silk, but porcelain, luxury products, furs, gold, and ideas. It also was the internet 1.0 because Islam traveled along these routes, Buddhism traveled along these routes, mathematics, philosophy, art. It was an extraordinary kind of flowering of culture in the Middle Ages.
Now, one of the first ancient traditions you came across was horse wrangling, as we heard a moment ago. What is a horse wrangler in Kazakhstan exactly, and what role do horse wranglers play in this region?
Well, I mean, horses traditionally are kind of iconic, right? Because the people of Kazakhstan have been mounted, since day one. They're some of the original riders, some of the people who, maybe whose ancestors helped invent things like the saddle, the things like stirrups. Those kind of horse technologies came out of these steppes of Central Asia. So there's this kind of cowboy mythos, if you will, of the Kazakh cowboys. And it's still very strong, but I have to say this. This is an irony of our modern world, walking through the world in the 21st century. When I landed in Western Kazakhstan, I had trouble finding Kazakh cowboys because the vast majority of them have resettled into cities, often pressured under the Soviet Union, because Kazakhstan is a former Soviet state, to relocate off the steppes. Authoritarian states don't like nomads because you can't control them. So they often force them into towns. And I had to actually train some guys to deal with the horses that we were carrying because I grew up in a village in Mexico, right? So I was using kind of central Mexican techniques. So the irony of me teaching a couple Kazakh guys was just not lost on myself, yeah.
You mentioned that you grew up in a small village in Mexico. Were there kind of parallels that you did see between that life and what you saw in Kazakhstan?
Absolutely. And I think it's one reason why on this whole global journey, when I moved through rural cultures, and about 80% of my foot journey has been rural, is that I have a little bit of an advantage in making connections with local rural people because that's the environment I grew up in. In Mexico, my neighbors were farmers, shepherds, people who were using their hands. So I grew up learning how to shoe a mule, how to manage a plow behind a mule. I can rub my fingers on a corn stalk and tell you how healthy it is. And this was invaluable in making connections in a place like Kazakhstan. Yeah, I felt at home.
Paul, I want to ask you about one of the first people you met in Kazakhstan, Andrei Astafyev, a researcher and archaeologist carving flint metal. You actually recorded a bit of sound of him working. Let's hear that. What's Andrei Astafyev doing here, Paul, and what's he saying?
Yeah, Andrei is demonstrating stone napping. He's basically showing me this amazing technology that we've forgotten. Not 99%, 99.9999% of the world today does not know how to map a stone. And by what I mean is like...
A map a stone? What does that even mean?
It means like create an arrow point, create a spear point by hitting a cobble against a piece of flint and creating a blade edge. Astafyev, because of his work with prehistoric archaeology in this part of the world, has taught himself these techniques, and he's making beautiful points. Often kind of, it's called experimental archaeology. And what he reminded me is that some of these edges are so sharp, they're one molecule thick. They're sharper than steel blades what? Used in surgery. And some of these kind of blades, stone blades, Marco, are even used in eye surgery today because you can actually cut into a cell. It's that sharp. So, yeah, I mean, it's astonishing that this heritage that we've had for, you know, more than 90% of our history, Stone Age technology, is so vanished and so gone. And here I found this Russian archaeologist who had kind of revived it just out of personal curiosity. That's one of the amazements of this walk, is you stumble across these really amazing people doing extraordinary things who are completely unheralded, right? Unsung.
How does Astafyev use these sharp stones?
Mainly in his research, mainly to see, you know, to try to understand the scatters of these little chips, that these flakes that come off the stone when you hit them. So he can, you know, Marco, he could actually find on the soil, on the ground in this vast flat grassland, scatterings of pieces of stone in a semicircle, and said, Paul, sometime in the Stone Age, maybe 8, 9, 10, 11,000 years ago, a dude was sitting here making a point, because they're the same pieces that I'm making myself. It's pretty, again, pretty remarkable.
That is amazing. You also met mystic healers in Kazakhstan. All right, Paul, set the scene for us. What's going on here? Who's talking, and what was this whole mystic experience like?
So this is a shaman on the outskirts of a town called Aktau in a cemetery, a necropolis. So this is another feature of this landscape, is you walk not just from well to well, but from necropolis to necropolis. These are kind of headstones, very weathered, sometimes covered with lichens that have been there for centuries. And he had taken a group of people out of the town of Aktau to do these ceremonies, these kind of shamanistic ceremonies, to heal them. He was a healer. And so Kazakhstan is Islamic, it's Muslim, but it has a very strong Sufic mystic streak to it. And what he was doing was blending Sufi Islam with pre-Islamic traditions from the nomads before Islam arrived in this area centuries ago. And those early people had a religion, shamanistic religion, that anthropologists today call Tengriism, which is kind of the worship of the blue sky and of the ancestors. And he was kind of having people jump over fires in the smoke. He was blowing into their ears, blowing into their eyes, to basically rid yourself of jinn, you know, evil spirits.
And there's someone else you met along the way, Paul, a man who played dombra music for you. I love the timbre of this instrument. Explain what the dombra is, what it looks like, and how important this instrument and the sound is to Kazakh culture.
So imagine an older gentleman sitting in a kind of a shack. And keep in mind that the step, when I say the word step, before I ever stepped on a step, is a flat sea of grass. Well, that's not really the case. The landscape is gently swelled, like the swells of an ocean, like the swells of waves. And so you have these swelling hills of grass going off 360 degrees all around you. The time I walked through, it was spring, so they were vibrant green. The grass was up to my knees and the horse's knees. And we come to this shack of a shepherd, and this guy's sitting there alone. He stays out there weeks at a time. And to entertain himself, he plays the dombra, this traditional instrument that has just a couple strings. And the sound is lovely. It sounds organic of the landscape. Originally, the dombra was made of native materials, right? It was made of sinew, of the animals, you know, the local woods. And the songs are very long. They can go on for hours and hours and hours. They're kind of iterative, right? Repeating the same phrase over and over, which reminds me of the landscape. It's kind of like the wind kind of strumming across the grass, if you will. Lovely.
If you could leave us with just one of your favorite memories from Kazakhstan, what would it be?
I think the sensory experience, the body experience of walking across a sea of grass will stay with me for the rest of my life. I've never been in a place, and Marco, I've been around the block even before this project. I've been to many, many different countries and continents. This swish, swish of seed heads, of grass against your legs for hour after hour, mile after mile, day after day, and the horizon just does not approach. You're just walking into this kind of two-framed painting of green and blue day after day after day. And, you know, that might sound kind of, you know, boring or kind of even a bit ominous, but it is actually exhilarating because what that low grass was, which I discovered, and occasional low shrubs, it was a forest. And that grass hid thousands of birds, mammals, reptiles, and it was like being a giant walking across a miniature forest where my head is way above the top of the canopy and just listening to all the life in the grass around me. You know, there were birds that the song just joined us as we walked across Western Kazakhstan, Mangistau for weeks, for about 500 kilometers, 350 miles. It was like just being serenaded atop a giant rainforest. It was amazing.
Just beautiful. Paul Salopek is a writer and National Geographic explorer. He continues his 24,000-mile storytelling trek across the world called the Out of Eden Walk. Paul, great to speak with you again.
Likewise, Marco. Until next time.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The movie Madagascar was a first encounter for many Americans with the baobab tree.
I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. Yeah, I like to move it.
In the film, you see these massive trees with thick trunks and no branches or leaves until the very top, so it looks almost like a shrub was plunked down on a tree trunk. Baobabs tower over the forest.
You may have thought DreamWorks animators had conjured them up, but they are real and in some ways the real kings of the jungle.
The baobab tree is a dominant force on the African landscape and the world's largest succulent plant. The baobabs can live for 1,000 years and grow so tall to heights equivalent to an 8-story building.
1,000 years is a long time. It is a survivor. A new study of the tree's DNA shows that baobab trees have been around close to 21 million years and did, in fact, originate on the island of Madagascar. The study, published in Nature, says that over time, baobab seeds were dispersed on ocean currents, giving rise to distinct species in Australia and across mainland Africa.
The baobab is sometimes called the tree of life because its fruit is a superfood. Its trunk can be used for making clothing and rope, and it also provides nesting sites for birds. But, and you knew there was going to be a but here, climate change and widespread deforestation are threatening the baobabs. Of the 13 largest baobabs in Africa, 9 have collapsed and died.
That part obviously not in the movie Madagascar.
ਗੱਲ ਸੁਣ ਲਲਾਰੀਆ ਵੇ ਆ ਲੋਕ ਮੇਰੇ ਤੇ ਹੱਸਦੇ
Karan Ojla is one of the hottest recording artists in the world right now. His music is part of what's being called the Punjabi Wave. Punjab is in northern India, but a lot of that Punjabi Wave is coming from Canada. The world's Anita Eilash hung out with some fans in a suburb of Toronto and brings us this story.
It's Bollywood night at the Indian restaurant Bay Fikr, one of the hottest dance clubs in Mississauga. The dance floor is packed. There are glitter balls and neon lights and a vibe that Nick Paul says reminds him of home back in India.
You don't need to understand the music. It just makes you dance.
Paul is talking about Punjabi hip-hop, which makes up a big part of the playlist. He's Punjabi himself, and like most of the crowd, he came to Canada as an international student.
I couldn't find my type of parties in Canada, but I don't think they have that rockness in them. Like, people are not so energetic.
He likes the music so much, he brought his mom, Saryu, who's visiting from India and is a big fan of these musicians.
They are 2,000% popular in India.
I cannot think of partying without them because it's so rocking and it's so much happening.
The music blends the Punjabi language with the sounds of global hip-hop, R&B, and trap music. Canadian musicians like Karan Aujla, A.P. Dillon, and Icky have topped global music charts with millions of monthly listeners and billions of streams. The late Punjabi-born rapper Sidhu Moosewala gets credit for starting the current wave.
Aye. Sidhu Moosewala. Bra.
Woo. His single Drippy was a big hit this spring, nearly 2 years after he was shot to death in India. Canadian Punjabi DJ Salini Dixit hosts a program on the international radio station Our FM 91.5. She says she gets calls from all over the world asking her to play the new Punjabi music.
Like they always say, music has no language. So if the beats are good, if the beats are foot tapping, even non-Punjabis enjoy the music.
Some of the lyrics are violent, and many of the songs deal with contemporary social issues, like racial tensions and the recent farmers' strikes in India. But Dixit says it appeals to South Asians of all backgrounds, because it also draws on everything from old folk songs to Bollywood. And for recent Indian immigrants, hearing the blend of Punjabi and Western influences is a point of pride.
And they are very happy about keeping the traditions alive. You know, we are very close to our roots. And we want to show it in front of the people how strong our roots are.
Punjabi wave superstar Diljit Dosanjh launched an international tour in Vancouver last month. 50,000 fans showed up for his stadium concert, the biggest crowd ever for a Punjabi artist outside India. Punjabi is now the fourth most spoken language in Canada. Like many of those Punjabi speakers, Karan Aujla came here as a young international student.
Oh my God. This is definitely a first one, but not the last one.
This spring, he won the Listener's Choice Award at the Junos, Canada's biggest music awards. Aujla came here to live with his sisters after his parents died 10 years ago. And he worked odd jobs before starting his music career.
And today I'm here, man. Let's go! I just want to end by saying this. If you're dreaming, make sure you dream big. Thank you, guys. I love you.
At the Bayficker Lounge, Nick Paul says that's something every international student can take inspiration from.
Like, it doesn't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter what your dads do, you just gotta show up, do the hard work, and you'll be up.
For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Mississauga, Ontario.
ਜਾਦੇ ਦੇ ਦੂੰਗੀ ਮੈਂ ਚਿੰਗ ਕਰ ਦੇਗਾ ਤਾਂ ਦੱਸ ਦੇ ਸੁਣ ਲਾ ਵੇ ਡਿਟੋ ਸੇਮ ਚਾਹੀਦੀ ਆਲਾ ਫੋਟੋ ਵੀ ਫਰਾਰੀ ਲਾਲ ਦੀ ਚੁੰਨੀ ਮੇਰੀ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਲਲਾਰੀਆ ਵੇ ਚੁੰਨੀ ਮੇਰੀ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਲਲਾਰੀਆ ਮੇਰੀ ਯਾਰ ਦੀ ਗੱਡੀ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ ਦੀ ਚੁੰਨੀ ਮੇਰੀ ਰੰਗ ਦੇ ਲਲਾਰੀਆ ਮੇਰੀ ਯਾਰ ਦੀ ਗੱਡੀ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ ਉਹ ਤਾਂ ਪੰਗੇ ਲੱਗਦੇ ਆ ਉਹਨੂੰ ਚੰਗੇ ਲੱਗਦੇ ਆ ਤਾਂ ਹੀ ਸੋਚਾਂ ਉੱਡਣਾ ਪਵਾਲਵਾ ਸੋਚਾਂ ਸ਼ਰੀਆਂ ਮਹੂਦਾ ਸੋਚਦੀਆਂ ਨਾ ਮੈਂ ਉਹਦਾ ਗੋਟੀ ਉੱਤੇ ਟੈਟੂ ਬਣਵਾਲਵਾ ਸੋਚਦੀ ਫਿਰਦਾ.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I am Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow on the show, we'll bring you the story of a taco stand in Mexico that made it into the Michelin Guide. This is the first year Michelin has gone to Mexico. It is about time.
Go get yourself a taco tonight, and we will see you right back here tomorrow.
ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਕਵਾਰੀਆਂ ਨੇ ਦੇਖੀ ਵੇ ਦੁਪੱਟੇ ਤੇਰੇ ਵਿਕਦੇ ਇੰਨੀ ਸੋਹਣੀ ਚੁੰਨੀ ਲੱਗੇ ਜੱਟੀ ਦੇ ਲਈ ਕਿ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਜਦੋਂ ਉਹ ਦੇਖੇਗਾ ਨਾ ਲਿਖਦੇ ਅੰਬ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਬੜੇ ਸੁਨਿਆਰੇ ਕੋਲੋਂ ਘੜੇ ਨਾਲੇ ਹਦੇ ਮੈਂ ਸੰਪੂਰਾ ਗੇੜਾ ਮਾਰਨਾ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਹੀ ਪਿਆਰੇ ਉਹਦਾ ਹੋਣਾ ਇਹਦੇ ਦਾ.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.